You know, first, we have a giant healthcare service delivery problem in the United States, in that we've got parts of the country where there are not primary care providers available, and there's not any of them coming. There's going to be a shortage of them. So we need primary care providers to get into parts of the country where people aren't living. Amazon's going to be able to, I think, scale that in a different way. You still are going to need to do physicals and have knee-to-knee with some people, so there's going to be some challenges. But for the most part, a lot of the care that's being neglected out in the world right now probably is going to be improved by virtue of Amazon's ability to scale and get this into places.
Hello, today I am talking again to returning guest Joseph Michelli. So, as you might remember, Joseph Michelli is an expert in customer experience. He is a psychologist by training. He's also a best-selling author, multiple books. That one there is the one we talked to him about last, which is called Customer Magic, which is actually by about one of our clients. It's about Macquarie Technology Group in Sydney, in Australia, who are a telco who have a fantastic world-beating customer experience story. And so that's a great book. And there is an episode on the podcast with Joseph and I talking about Macquarie Technology Group and Customer Magic. But today we're talking about One Medical, which is his new book, which is just about to come out, called All Business is Personal. So imagine going to a doctor and getting the type of care that you might expect if you were to have the love child of the Ritz-Carlton, which is another book he's written about Ritz-Carlton, the love child of Ritz-Carlton and, I don't know, your doctors, I guess, which is not my experience going to a GP in the UK. But One Medical was started by one doctor who said, the healthcare experience is shocking, we can do better than this. And it's not just that the service is excellent, but that the performance of the business is absolutely staggering. They have a net promoter of 90 plus. The patients that come through their system, they go to accident and emergency 40% fewer times. The staff who work in their business have lower turnover, which is amazing because normally healthcare has a very, very high churn. So not only is it an amazing service business, people pay money. You have to pay money out of your own pocket over and above your insurance costs to be part, to be a member of One Medical. And they did amazingly well. And Amazon bought them recently for $4 billion. So it is a fantastic story. So it'd be great to pick, Joseph's brains, find out what's at the core of this business and how do they do it. And a fantastic book. So also that will be out soon on all good bookshops. So fantastic conversation with Joseph. Lovely to have him on again. I think he's the only guest I've had on four times. So brilliant. Welcome back, Joseph Michelli.
Hi, it's Joseph Michelli. I help leaders create loyalty and referrals from their existing customer base. That's what I do.
Ooh, loyalty. Do you have a technical definition in mind?
I always think of it as simply repeat business because I think it gets very difficult to translate in terms of KPIs unless you talk about that. And then when I think about referrals, I really am talking about what percentage of your new customers come in thanks to the suggestion of your existing customers. So those are the way I look at it in a very pragmatic kind of way. Obviously, there are lots of drivers to what it takes to get somebody to be loyal, and even more if they're loyal to get them to say your name in the public square.
It's interesting. So when I was at Rackspace, and you know, I'd rolled out Net Promoter Score because Fred had written about it in the Harvard Business Review, and we were looking for some metric. We did a survey and, you know, we asked our customers, like, how did you get here? Because, of course, until we realized that we should be asking them, we hadn't been asking them. And people said, oh, you know, somebody told me about you. And then, you know, you get talking to people and you sort of say, well, you know, we're a web infrastructure business. You know, we're like the plumbers of the internet. What we do is a bit dull. So how did we come up in conversation? And they said, oh, I was at a barbecue and some guy said, who do you host with? And you're like, man, that is a terribly dull barbecue to be at, that people are talking about web infrastructure at a barbecue. But that, you know, you just like, don't invite me to that barbecue. But in that context, then people have thought it's, and, you know, like, feel passionate enough about a B2B product, infrastructure product. It's not like hair and beauty. It's not going to make you richer or sexier or faster or live longer. It's just, you know, where does your website live? And you know, people talk about it. And, you know, we were chatting before we were recording about people copying, you know, what you do. We would say, look, our existing customers grow, the revenue from our existing customers grows up 4% a month. Our larger customers, 4% a month, even if we do nothing, even if we don't win a new customer, like we're growing 4% a month. We'd say that and our competitors would hear us and we would say it's all through word of mouth. Then there's this massive gap. They can intellectually understand what it is you've said that you do, but none of their customers are ever referring them, ever. And they're absolutely at zero. It's such a big gap. It's such a sort of like, where would we start? How would we get this? How would it not be shit? In the end, people go, do you know what? I think we should just cut some costs because if we had a higher margin, then, you know, that's one way we could compete. And they just don't, because they don't know how to cross this chasm. Because if you've got customer referrals, you've got no sales and marketing costs.
Yeah. And the more you focus on cutting those costs, what you're really doing is trying to commoditize yourself in terms of just being a product focused business. We're talking about an experiential value proposition where people do feel some emotional connection to a brand beyond the transactional value the brand brings to them, you know, peace of mind, potential for growth, the give a damn factor. You know, they give a damn about me and they don't just transact business as if I'm just an object to them. But to go back to your net promoter score, let's assume that I do have promoters, lots and lots and lots of them. How do I take that? Because Fred has really over time evolved to realize it is not the ultimate question when it comes to referrals. It is a pretty powerful question when it comes to likelihood to repurchase. So repurchase intent, it has a fairly good predictor on. But how do I activate referrals? Now I got to take those promoters and I got to figure out, and I think the way you did it, Dom, is really amazing. I mean, if you reverse engineer it and say, what are the people who actually do recommend me? What are they saying? Where are they saying it? What can I do to better understand why they would say it so that I can activate those mechanisms inside of my loyal nines and 10 promoters on an NPS score, right? Like, how do I help them help me tell more about the opportunity they have to work with us?
Can we just keep talking about referrals for a bit?
Oh, sure.
I've got some things that, you know, that I've used, tools I've used before, but what are some of the things that, you know, you've covered some fantastic businesses in your career and written books on many of them, but what are some of the referral strategies that people are using? Like, how do you activate those nines and tens?
One of the first things you have to do from the beginning of a relationship with any customer is saying, I want to earn a 9 or 10. And I don't want you to ever give me a 9 or 10. I want to have, you know, without doubt earned it from you. So that I need you to know that. And if I do, I just want to let you know I am in a referral business. So from the beginning, you kind of got to say, I'm fully committed to giving you a rock star experience. And by the way, I also am living and dying by being able to have people, you know, introduce me to other people for whom that experience can be there. The other thing you have to do early on is suggest that if you do make that referral, I'm still going to be here for you. The challenge of people's referrals is that they may love you a lot, but worry that if they actually start telling people about it, your service levels to them will go down. And I think that's a psychological trick. I mean, think about the restaurant, that like quaint little restaurant that you only know about and you kind of want to tell people, but on the other hand, it's going to be harder to get a reservation on that Friday night like you can now, given it's current traffic. So there is a real element in understanding that. I also think you have to appeal to the fact that people want to be in the know and share with people they love things that make them cool by referring. So the referral process is a coolness factor. Like, I am so smart, I chose them, and I want to tell you how smart I am by telling you how smart they are, right? I mean, it's a very strange psychological reality that we're getting at. And so it does take some work to be able to say, because you felt that you had a positive experience with us, because you made that choice, and because you care about other people, wouldn't it be great if you could avail those other people to what you were able to find? And I think that's the way you go about it. And obviously, that's the most stark version of it. But you're working on that from your messaging platform all the time. Like, you're a smart person. You found us. Make that happen.
Yeah, pay it forward, which makes you feel good about yourself. But also, also teeing up at the beginning to say, I'm giving you a great service. I want you to refer, you know, you owe it to others. Somebody referred you to us. You should refer us onward. Tactically, one of the things that I found is that the engineers in the B2B businesses that I work with, engineer I use loosely, I mean not sales and marketing, they say, well, once we've sold a thing to somebody, once they've bought it and experienced it, we should then ask them how it was. And I said, I think you're asking at the wrong point. I said, this is an emotional thing. And often I do this, if I'm speaking, I say, look, has anyone bought a car recently? And somebody will go, oh, I bought a car. Okay. Now, did you tell people you'd bought the car when you bought the car or when you got the car delivered? And they go, oh, the moment I bought the car, I told everyone I bought a new car. I said, but you haven't got it. No, haven't got it yet. Have you driven it? No. But you've told everyone you've got it. Yes. People are prepared to refer you at the point where they feel that they've made a wise decision. You don't have to ask later. So people often ask too late in the customer journey.
I love that because I think you really are seizing on the emotional point where people are extremely excited before you've had a chance to let them down with your service, right? Yes. And the challenge should be to try to make sure that you don't let your product down. You don't let the emotional experience that people come into a relationship with down. Now, there's normally a honeymoon period and people do tend to drop a bit in their enthusiasm for a product. Then you have to design in your overall customer journey an opportunity to recapture that energy and momentum fairly early on in that onboarding process to get them back into the enthusiasm and excitement. And those are, again, design strategy movements that help you build a consistent journey where referrals are going to happen anywhere along the journey, right? Like they're going to happen upon, wow, like I found this really cool provider, but it's also going to happen when they onboarded me and they really re-engaged me by virtue of. So I love where you're going. And I think ask for the referral repeatedly throughout this journey.
Yes.
And it's a fair thing to do. If you're creating value, make sure that they can help you access people like them, because this marketing thing's really hard, right? Like we have a product of value. It's optimized for some group. We try to target market them. We actually get some of them to buy the product. Now's the time to leverage the people who've crossed that buying line to help get you access to people like them. And so I love working on referrals. And I think the first step, as you suggested earlier, is really being able to say to someone straight away, I am in the referral business and I want to be able to earn your satisfaction, your engagement, your wow, and your referrals.
And how many of the businesses that you have worked with or written about did that design thinking work around the service, or how many were led by? I'm just thinking about Ritz-Carlton, and you know, I had Hirsch on the show, and it didn't feel to me like he sat down and designed it. He had a throbbing heart, like he felt what this needed to look like. He had a vision about how it would come together. Have any of them designed anything like from the bottom up, or do they iterate from an original vision?
That's a crazy good observation, particularly about Horst, who is a good friend of mine, and we talk probably once a month. So Horst was doing it without having a formal design process in place. Like he didn't have a touchpoint journey map, and it was on the wall, and no, that would not be Horst. But Horst was walking into the building, and he was saying, what's creating value here? And what do we need to do more of? What do we need to do less of? How do we maximize value at every touch point? So he was doing it. It was just inside of this magnificent brain of his. Other brands like Mercedes were so far off. They were not doing it at all. They were doing no value mapping along the journey. They were value mapping every part of the design of the vehicle and not value mapping any part of the journey. Thus, we had these dealerships where people would come in and buy a $120,000 US S-Class, and they would write the CEO and say, it was almost as if they, you know, were giving me the privilege of purchasing this car the way they treated me. Like it was such disrespectful. So, you know, in that case, we really did get down to every touch point needed to be analyzed, which we did. We had to train people on the most high value touch points. We needed to train them on best practices to execute at those high value touch points to drive metrics that we were wanting to compete on in the marketplace here in the US. That's JD Powers. But beyond that, we also had to get some some ability to get emotional, to drive delight, thus the title of the book, Driven to Delight. We had to drive that emotional charge, delight, not just a satisfying journey that would show up in the, you know, the J.D. Power's Customer Satisfaction Index.
And what were some of those things that you found?
It was everything, it seemed like, in their world. But, you know, there's things like, some of it was really simple. Like, we're trying to sell a car that has monster technology, not all of which you could demo you know, in the on the showroom lot. So just having an iPad where we could demonstrate to you some of these incredible technology features had multiple emotional value, and it actually increased the overall sales price of the car by about $500. In other words, if we could show you all this value that we were otherwise not being able to, we were leaving, you know, outside of your consciousness, we could show it and we could demonstrate it by using technology itself, right? Like, we're telling you about this amazing, you know, these anti-lock braking individual sensors on every wheel, so the car is smarter than any human could brake it, right? But we can't do that unless we we're doing that like on a piece of paper, right? Like, you know, I mean, it was not resonating that this truly was a technology progressive brand that could, you know, create an enveloping experience in the showroom. So my I guess what I'm saying is that we had to look at all of those things and say, what's going to drive delight? What's going to drive emotional engagement? And what's going to create the sense of value that they're going to enjoy when they drive this car?
And it was that on the back of that was when they is that when they decided to acquire some of their dealers and be fully integrated so that they could manage it all the way to the customer?
Yeah, originally it was only one owned and operated dealer in the U.S., and that was in Manhattan. And the beauty of having a small number of those, and in any case, is you can test lots of new ideas in the customer journey. So I'll just give you the Manhattan store before you talk about getting more and more dealers involved. But in the Manhattan owned and operated store, we were doing things like RFID chipping vehicles for near field beacons, right? So when you brought your car within about a block of the Mercedes dealership, that beacon would fire, and it did two things. It set a ticker board as you arrived with your name on it, welcoming you as you drove your car in. And it sent a task on the pager of the employee to come down curbside so that your concierge would meet you curbside, your service concierge would meet you curbside when you came into the service bay. So these were things we could test when we got that. And then when we showed that there was value and we worked through whatever the privacy issues were, which is slapping those things on cars without people's permission, then, you know, then we could roll it out and say, look, this is, we're getting great emotional engagement scores upon arrival because we are personalizing that experience with a blend of technology and humans, which is really where my world goes these days. I live in a, how do we make technology make human connection greater, as opposed to how do we just get more chatbots available so that people can conveniently get questions answered, but in a hugely commoditized transactional way.
That's a great segue into your latest book, which I see bigger than life size behind you, at least a little bit of it. For those of you watching on the podcast, All Business is Personal, which is the story of One Medical, which if you're in the US, you might have heard of, and in the UK, you probably have never heard of.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't have heard of them, but there's they were acquired for $4 billion in 2023 by a brand that you may have heard of called Amazon. Yeah, what they do, it's fairly interesting. It all started a long, long time ago. Children sit down with our blankies, and here's the story. So this guy named Tom Lee, he was a Harvard-trained internal medicine doctor who then apparently didn't have enough education. So he went to Stanford to get his MBA on top of that. And he did this around the time when we were still in the BlackBerry era, and he developed an app for physicians as part of his Stanford master's degree program. He developed an app for physicians for their BlackBerries where they could get all the physician's desk reference information, you know, what drug interactions you have with medications. And it was kind of integrating technology with an old giant book that physicians had to use to refer to and updating it. So that was his contribution to transforming healthcare. But beyond a product, he really thought that he wanted to get at the service level and how could we transform the service experience. And so he started asking questions. He just asked why. Why here in the United States do we need to go and sit in a waiting room at a doctor's office only to then sit in an exam room waiting for the doctor to come into the exam. So we have like these two waiting areas, if you will, in the waiting room, sit in the exam room, partially attired, waiting for the person to come in, right? And so those kind of questions, why did we always have to schedule those appointments by phone? Why do we have to call in to get an appointment? So in the early days, you just start challenging all of the assumptions that are involved in delivering primary care. And he said, I'm just going to try something different. And he created this, he had got a bunch of technologists. They were based out of the San Francisco area, Silicon Valley. He got a bunch of technologists to help him develop an app where people could make their appointments online, where physicians and providers could do medical records long before the electronic medical record. They were integrating AI to be able to, you know, capture what was happening in the exam room with the permission of the patient so that the provider didn't have to pay attention and treat the chart, and so that the provider wasn't writing chart notes in their jammies late at night, right? So that was the journey. And he did what Gilmore and Pine said in their legendary book, Experience Economy. He did it so well that people would pay admission to have the experience.
Right.
They were not, they still had to build their insurance for all their care. Like the insurance was still the primary payment for the care. But people were paying $49 for the access to the One Medical experience as a member of One Medical. And the gist of this was it was in such a time that they didn't have, you know, e-commerce. So he asked his people if they would send in $49 via a check to him. Some did, some didn't. He kept them all in there in the membership early on. But now, you know, Amazon bought them. And now for $99 US, you can be a member of this experience as part of the Prime offer that Amazon has for expedited delivery and other benefits. So it has really been an integrated part of membership, the Prime membership of Amazon, and now membership to One Medical, or Amazon One Medical as they're referred to today.
So is it virtual or is it in person?
Both. I mean, they were way ahead on the virtual access. Yeah, they were way ahead on virtual access before, not, you know, before COVID. And that really, you know, everybody got into that after that. But yeah, you can do either. So let's pretend I'm traveling to San Francisco. I'm based out of Florida. I'm traveling to San Francisco today. And I get there and I have this really scratchy, itchy throat and my eyes are burning and I don't know what I've got. And so I'm going to go on my app and they're going to ask me 20 questions, you know, curate me into deciding and really triaging me based on my symptom presentation. Do I need to go to an emergency room because I got something that I better just get taken care of? Or is it something I just push this button that says treat me now, and within a couple of minutes, they will access a provider for me for a video chat on my phone, which is going to be a provider in California, right? Licensed in the state of California, because I can't be, they have to have that provider there. Let's assume I just need a medication. They'll be sending it to, you know, Amazon Pharmacy, which is integrated with them. They can immediately ask Amazon Pharmacy to ship it to my hotel where I am. I could get it same day probably in San Francisco. And then by that night, I'm taking the medication ready for my event the next day. When I'm found that I break my leg in Milwaukee and need to go through the whole same process. So,
but it's when he started it, it doesn't sound again like he's the CEO founder is somebody who has doing a design process. He's just going, this is just awful. Like, you know, I was just thinking that the one place in the UK, maybe there's a few places, but certainly if I think doctor surgery in the UK, I think that is the last bastion of no customer service or denial of service. You know, I ignore you, treat you badly, I be rude. Doesn't matter what they do, you will keep coming back because there is, you know, it's free. And so there's, you know, why would you pay? You know, most people just keep putting up with it. And also because it's doctors, and doctors are so important. That's why you end up sitting around, because they're important. So we're less important, they're more important. So we should wait. It's our time that's less important than the doctors. And that's a historic.
Well, I'll go to your question of design. I think you realized that it was just broken all over the place. Like it was just broken. And rather than trying to iteratively improve it, which is really the mistake I think I made over my career, is that most of the time I just say, well, you know, this process has come about honestly, and it's built by other people, and I don't want to just blow it up. I'm going to try to make this bad process better for clients or customers. No, I mean, this guy basically said, let's start from scratch. And let's think about what the optimal experience would look like upon arriving in their clinic. So when you do arrive, 97% of the time, you're going to be treated within 3 minutes of your scheduled appointment time. I mean, that's how it's been executed. Your provider will come out and they will greet you right at your seat in street clothes, you know, not street, in appropriate professional attire, but not that clinical doctor-y look thing. And they'll walk you back. They'll have start their conversation with you about why you're there for the day. As you're walking into the exam room, you're going to sit right down in the exam room with them. They'll do whatever they need. If they need to do vitals, they'll do it. But typically, they won't put you through going to the scale to weigh yourself unless that's a relevant reason for you being in there today, right? I mean, why do you need that pain point and that trauma moment when it's not relevant to many clinical conditions? I have a sinus infection. How much do you weigh? I mean, it doesn't really make sense. So all of that has been redesigned in the way they execute the experience now. And then the post-care follow-up messaging communication stuff. They're designing population medicine. So when you turn 50, I know that's many, many years down the road for you, Dom. But when you turn 50, they're going to send you a ColaGuard kit, and a task on your app that says, we just sent you this thing so you can do just a fecal sample and put it in this thing and send it to us. And we're going to get, a pre colonoscopy avoidance screening for some kind of colon related cancer. So they're just doing lots of things that are proactive in your health journey. That's saving costs, improving outcomes, and improving the patient experience through their membership model. So I think they have designed it after blowing it up.
So, and I might have picked up the wrong number here from the text, but, if I think about, Ritz-Carlton versus some other hotel group, like Best Western, right? I can see why I'd be paying more to be in a Ritz-Carlton. But here, One Medical, actually, their cost of delivering the care went down. Right. So it's not like it's all expensive and the costs go up, which is sort of feels like you might expect it to, like in Ritz-Carlton, their hotels probably cost more to build than a Best Western. Here, their prevention of diabetes, their cost, their intervention actually showed that this thing that, prevention is better than cure. The whole American medical system is built on, the insurance companies sort of don't want you to be better because it breaks their business model. So this is, what was the scale of the reducing the cost of care?
Let me interrupt the conversation just for a minute because I don't want you to miss this. My new book, Mind Your Fucking Business, is out on Amazon. If you're thinking yet another business book, I think you're wrong. This is actually a blueprint to cutting through the noise and achieving unparalleled success for you. It's based on 10 years of business coaching, spotting similar problems that people have had and coming up with real world solutions. If it's supercharging sales, if it's mastering talent acquisition, building a powerhouse brand, cultivating a company culture that breeds success, then this book is a ticket to your transformative journey. It's filled with practical tools and frameworks that I use every single day with my clients as part of their coaching program. If you want to take your business from good to great, look, you can go to Amazon and you can buy it, or you can click the link in the show notes and head over to monkhouseandcompany.com. I'll send it to you today. I'll send you a copy for free. I want to help you build a fantastic business. Now, back to the conversation.
You're absolutely right that the historical model of treatment in the United States is fee for service. So the more service I can bill you, the more benefit I'm going to get as a provider. However, the insurance companies are becoming savvy to this now. So their formulas of reimbursement are based on a variety of variables and quality as well as patient engagement. So they are asking patients, what was the experience like? And if you're a terrible experience provider, then that's going to affect your reimbursement rate for what you bill, right?
Okay.
And if your clinical outcomes suck royally, let's say you have higher, return rates to hospital because of that, or your surgical outcomes are inferior to the baseline, your reimbursements are going to go down. And the AI on their databases that suggest, who you might want to go see goes down, and you might not make a panel on that insurance over the time. So all these variables are starting to come together. It's still a fee-for-service model for the most part, though there are capitated service areas. So I might take a case rate for a senior citizen to take care of them for the next 10 years of their life. So as a provider, if I'm getting that case rate and you've contracted me for that, I want to find every way possible to have groups for diabetes education, not just be trying to manage the long-term, extremely expensive consequences of unregulated diabetes.
Did it reduce 45% lower medical claims costs? Is that the stat? Did I pull out the right stat?
It did. And so it definitely, absolutely.
Amazing.
And so would you not want to try to encourage people to get into care with a primary care physicians group that's managing you comprehensively and focused on cost outcomes? So the win-win should not just be patient. It should not be provider. It should not just be insurance company. It really needs to be ecosystem. So if you're going to use your technologies and you're going to create great experiences, you want to try to treat all of those pieces, or else you never really fix the healthcare debacle that has been the US. And I think it's also a debacle in other parts of the world as well.
I was just amazed that I could see how you would design for service and that would be better and that might attract patients. But the fact that it's better and then the outcomes are better and then the cost to deliver. So that whole, what do you call it? Technology-enabled human-centric service. Is that your...
Yeah, that's my thing. I think I call it that. Yeah, human-centered, technology-enabled, technology-aided, any of those terms are fine by me. What does the sign say? Let's see what... Technology-powered. Yeah, that's the one.
And again, the job satisfaction for the doctors in that business versus outside of that business? Because again, I have this thing, which is, I think it's impossible to deliver great service if your staff don't love your business first.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And, I spend a lot of time in the book about, managing while walking around and a lot of the strategies that they use. And there's a high performance culture there, too. I mean, they are very much Lean Six Sigma oriented in terms of driving efficiencies. But there's a huge, huge effort to make sure that they're not overworking staff. And unfortunately, in healthcare, they just burn staff out. The greatest, the brightest, the most passionate people leave the profession because it's untenable. The amount of work that's being put on them, both in terms of patient care, as well as all the documentation overload, or the managing referrals, or the managing the medicine, or dealing with the insurance companies and the documentation requirements for them. The real effort here is to not just deploy your technologies for the purpose of making the life of patients better, but also to try to make the life of these team members better and to have the AI learning constantly how to streamline requests and queries and really triage so that physicians and providers are pulled in for the least amount of things and the rest of the administrative staff. You know, right now, let's say I got my app out for One Medical and I said, I just have a question about my insurance. And I text that into the app. That's going to immediately get queued into the administrative queue and become a task on someone using the AI's wisdom to send that to a task on somebody who specializes insurance, right? It's not being sent to the front desk of a healthcare clinic where the front desk person has to put me on hold and then contact somebody and they don't have the information. And, it's just a much more efficient process. If I say I have the sniffles, it's going to go into the clinical queue, right? It's going to pick up that word and it's going to take me into the clinical queue. And that task will be put on the desk of somebody who's specifically related to clinical triage.
Without you having to listen to a recorded message telling you how important this call is to you. But that we're just a bit busy, unprecedented demand at the moment.
But it'll be 20 minutes, we'll get to you. Your business is so important to us that we're neglecting you for the next 20 minutes. Amen.
Please don't die. Please don't die whilst you're on hold.
Or record this and put it on social media, which is what's happening more and more. I've been waiting on hold, and then they show you the phone on social media for the last 5 hours to talk to my internet provider.
Oh, so what do you think is going to happen? Do you think Amazon will kill it or will it be great still? Will it be better? Will it be bigger and better than ever?
Well, first off, I hope to sell a bunch of books. I hope to sell a bunch of books on Amazon. So can you ask me this question after the book is out there for a while? Well, I think there is risk to Amazon being involved and there's benefit. I mean, obviously, The scalability of the Amazon value proposition is amazing. The ability to, you know, first, we have a giant healthcare service delivery problem in the United States, in that we've got parts of the country where there are not primary care providers available, and there's not any of them coming. There's going to be a shortage of them. So we need primary care providers to get into parts of the country where people aren't living. Amazon's going to be able to, I think, scale that in a different way. You still are going to need to do physicals and have knee-to-knee with some people. So there's going to be some challenges. But for the most part, a lot of the care that's being neglected out in the world right now probably is going to be improved by virtue of Amazon's ability to scale and get this into places. That said, Amazon is a supply chain business. I get it. They're also in the cloud and a lot of other things. But for the most part, really, their strengths are in supply chain. So that tends to be more product and process focused than people focused, generally speaking. And as a result of that, I would suggest to you, they're going to have some challenges understanding how to translate the technology and not lose the soul of the humanity of the experience delivery. So I think we're in an early chapter in that book. We'll see how it plays out. But the book that I've really built for the most part is, why would Amazon want to buy a company like this? And that's what we currently have out on the table. So
is it getting good enough to fake sincerity? Like, because at the moment, good customer service has to be delivered by, or amazing customer service has to be delivered by, people who get joy from giving it, because otherwise it's never great. It's just, it's just okay, right? You know, you go into a bar or a restaurant and the server does an okay job and you leave and it was an okay experience, and the decor and the food are the same and the server is amazing and you have an amazing night, right? Like, the human interaction creates the experience. How close are we that, not in person, obviously, but AI interactions, online, digital AI interactions can fake the humanness of great experience?
No, it can do everything else but. I think we're right still there, right? Like, that's the place that, let's get real, Dom. You know, at the end of this interview with you today, I will authentically tell you I am appreciative, because I am, right? If AI told you that, you would snicker and go, yeah, right, yeah. I've never felt that AI could tell me I matter. It can tell me what I like, what I've purchased. It can take all the wisdom of the universe and give me instructions on how to try to communicate that to somebody. But when it gets right down to it, now, I say that, and there are people who are falling in love with their AI. Don't get me wrong. There are those AI girlfriends and AI boyfriends and all of that. But people at some macro level know, I mean, they can find themselves seduced into it. But for the, at some macro level, they know this is just software. Human beings can fake sincerity too, though. And we as human beings have come to learn a lot about how to read when people are authentic or not. And so you just, I mean, having inauthentic people and inauthentic AI, neither of them get you very far. So you want to hire people who actually care about people, or, you know, you need to be able to fake it a lot better than AI is doing it right now, for sure. Because I don't see anything that sells me on it cares about me.
Is caring about people in the can't teach bucket? Do I have to filter for people who care, or can I teach you to care?
I think you can activate caring in people who may have been a little burned out on caring, and you need to keep it fresh, because people can care and they can lose that. So you need to have to rekindle the spark sometimes. But if that, if there's no fire in there and there's no basic DNA for it, you can't, you know, you can't put it in. You can't put in what God left out. That's my opinion.
When you think about technology and human interaction, what are you most excited about? Is there a gap where you go, I think this is where the people and AI are going to come together and solve this problem that has so far been unsolved? Or
I think there are problems we can't even begin to imagine are going to get solved with the combination of AI and humans. Anything where we need complex analysis of themes and data that AI can help us process. And then we have humans who are willing to take what it learns and come up with new ideas about how to forge forward. We're going to be great. I think the problem is that people don't really understand the difference between AI and human reasoning and the unique value propositions thereof. You know, looking at macro trends and being able to deal with massive data sets at a level we could not begin to parse is the future benefits of this. But it's not going to innovate in the truest sense of innovation, because it's designed to just build on what is. And so the notion of thinking outside of the box, no, it is the box. It is so much of what's in the box. It's going to help us understand, appreciate, and use. But I'm still convinced that true creativity is human. And so what you see is little micro shift innovations within AI. Try to get AI to write a song. It's going to be a lot like a lot of other songs that have been written. It's not going to be a novel, wild song that has never been even conceptualized. And I think if you take it at that level, that's the same thing with business. The more we're willing to get all of the best threads and say, now what? And how do we do something that zigs when AI would otherwise zag?
Fab. That's magic. So when is your book out? Out soon? When's
It's out soon, yeah. May 13. So yeah, I'm psyched about that release. And it's available in Audible and all those other forms. So if people want to listen to it without having to pay all the potential tariffs that could be related to purchasing a book from the United States, we'll leave it at that. I think you should be able to access the digital stream fairly easily.
Fab. Well, good luck with the launch. What other books, as well as putting this in my pre-order basket, what other books do you think people should pick up if this human-centric, technology-driven, or customer experience thing is something they want to dive more into?
I'll give you four of them really quickly. For me, The AI-Driven Leader, which was written by Jeff Woods, is, I think, a great book because it really is, how do we make faster decisions with AI. I'm a fan of Jeff Blunt's book, People Buy You, really kind of focusing on how do we get them to get the essence of what you are. I love Lead Like Lasso. That's kind of a blend between the UK and the US in that concept, right? Football in our, you know, soccer, football. Yeah. So Lead Like Lasso. I just love that series. I'm glad they're having another one come. And I think the wisdom of Ted Lasso extrapolated in that book. I'm trying to remember who wrote it. It was well done. And then A CEO Only Does Three Things. It's a great book by Trey Taylor, kind of focusing on what it really takes to a leader to be disciplined and what you want to be known for and the core elements that every business executive should be considering.
Fab. Joseph, that's absolutely brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. Where can people find you? Are you everywhere, Joseph Michelli?
I am horrid. Yeah, I'm horridly present with my name. So if you can spell my name, you can find me. My Joseph Michelli is my LinkedIn. My website is josephmichelli.com. So, you know, I think you'll find me.
Brilliant. Joseph, absolute pleasure chatting to you again. Thanks for coming on.
Twas my pleasure always. Thank you so much, Dom.